Welcome to Project Update, a weekly podcast about the projects we're working on and the friends we made along the way. I'm Dave Ramsey.
And I'm Joe Simpson.
How's it going this week, Joe?
Doing pretty good. We have friends now?
We have friends. We have invited a friend of the show, Charles Delfs, to stop in and say hi and give us a project update on his solution, FM Better Forms. Charles, how's it going?
Hey, guys. Thanks. It's going great. Thanks. And thanks for having me on the show today.
Yeah. Welcome. So I guess let's dive in. I know the least about FM Better Forms. I've talked to you a little bit about it. You were helping me with some Vue stuff when Dave and I were first getting FM Comparison up and running on the front end. And I want to thank you for introducing me to Tailwind.
Yeah, Tailwind's really, really exciting. So
it's fantastic.
I'll tell you a bit about FM Better Forms, just so to add a bit of background context.
Please.
Basically, Better Forms is a web publishing front end for FileMaker. So it's very specifically designed for FileMaker. Although it's not underneath the hood, we kept things pretty agnostic. But our primary clients are FileMaker developers. And we basically are an app builder, a web app builder for that platform. And our biggest advantage is that we give people the ability to scale apps up, you know, into the hundreds or thousands of users while maintaining their existing database. And as far as a project goes and what things sort of apply to Project Update is, you know, I'm playing the home game as I'm listening to you guys each week. And I'm saying, yeah, I got that problem. Oh, I had that problem. And oh, I'm going to make sure I don't run into that problem that Dave just ran into and told me all about. So so I can kind of relate to a lot of those things. Our stack is pretty deep. We take care of things from DevOps. So we have a multi-data center, multi-node, multi-cluster Kubernetes type environment. And we run Node.js back on top of that. And then that Node.js runs on the front end, it runs Vue.js primarily. Although, unlike the average Vue.js app, our app really doesn't really have much code. Like, you know, there's not a lot of divs and tags in our code because it's all dynamically generated. So that's kind of a fundamental difference between us and most other applications. And then on the back end, we connect to FileMaker. So we connect up to FileMaker through the XML gateway or through the data API. It's a really easy switch over for the developers as well.
Oh, so I didn't know you did both.
Yeah. We actually introduced the data API about 6 months ago. And it's kind of funny because everybody said, oh, we need the data API. And then we released it and we couldn't find anybody to even do data testing. Because it was one of those features that everybody is like, I have to have this. And then it's like, okay, they don't bother changing it because there's really no performance difference from our perspective. We do a lot of optimization so that we're not querying the gateways with multiple records like you would normally would. Let's say if you had a PHP backend and the logic sat in PHP. Mm-hmm. Instead, what we do is we do a fundamental concept that's different is we use a single record and a single field at that, and we push the data in and out that way, and that becomes very performant. So that's the main difference why the gateways perform almost identically.
Huh.
So I noticed a few podcasts ago, if I can kind of dive back, and sure. You had mentioned Tailwinds and or Tailwind. I always say Tailwinds for some reason, so I think they should change the name. I remember watching a preview. And Adam Wathan, one of the authors of Tailwind, he talked about it, and I didn't give it too much thought, because it's, you know, just another framework, another CSS framework, or another thing to learn, and I didn't really take too much interest. And then I was at VueConf, I guess about 3 years ago in Amsterdam, and somebody had talked about it, and they said, just as they closed their presentation, they said, if you're not using Tailwind, use it. And they just walked off the stage. And it's like, that was pretty confident, right? That was pretty bold. So I went and checked it out. Well, you know, because everybody's sitting there with their laptops on their lap. And I thought, wow, this is pretty cool. And it turns out that for us to incorporate that into Better Forms, we basically just drop a CDN tag in the DOM area of your site, and boom, you have Tailwind, and it's crazy powerful. So I think if you haven't tried that as a FileMaker developer, it's definitely the way to go in terms of architecting apps, and understanding, you know, you're not digging into to CSS. You're not trying to learn a whole bunch of CSS hierarchy, even for that matter, because everything is scoped for the most part right to the particular tag.
Yeah, so it's the closest that I've ever seen to basically HTML, being able to edit HTML similar to the way you edit in FileMaker, where you're just defining things in the inspector. In this case, it's a GUI in the inspector, and you're just adding values next to those. In Tailwind, you're just adding in the classes in the HTML class.
Yeah.
Attribute. And it's hard to explain. Like, it took me a while to wrap my head around, but everything is just, every class just does one thing. So it's not like you're not importing named classes that do a bunch of things. So, yeah.
Yeah. The whole idea of utility classes is super, super powerful. Like, what, so if somebody's not, if anybody's not familiar with the utility class first base CSS architecture, basically the idea is you have a tag, like let's say your H1 tag, and you add a class tag in it so you can define it. Now, normally you would go into your CSS file and you'd say dot company red equals, and then it would be something like, you know, color, you know, whatever the red color number is for that, and so on. And then in your class tag, you would add company red, or company hyphen red probably. And with Tailwind, you do it differently. So every class is already predefined with a very, very small single use. So in other words, I would put text hyphen red hyphen 600, and that would give me a nice red. And I would put P hyphen 4, and that would give me some padding around it. And I can just build it out. And what's really cool is in our editor, and I think you guys saw it one time on a call, is we have our HTML editor is live. It renders right as you type. So you can literally be typing these classes out and see this thing build up right in real time, which is incredibly rewarding. And it's amazing how quickly developers who have never done any front end design can build things and get things looking like the way they want to.
Yeah, it's kind of an odd collection of like shorthand. It basically feels like shorthand for CSS. And Dave and I were on a call, on a meeting a couple weeks ago, and he asked me to change something, and I found the line and just typed in what to him looked like a bunch of inscrutable characters. And he's like, I'm not crazy about the fact that there's a large portion of my app that I have no idea how it works.
Like, yeah. Yeah,
you get used to it.
That's right. But, and people learn it really, really quick. So
yeah,
I'll say the same thing. If you haven't tried Tailwind, try it.
Yeah. Coming in from the outside as somebody who still doesn't fully understand how Tailwind works, because Joe's handling all of that for me, it completely streamlined our UI development process. Like, prior to Tailwind, every time we would start talking about the UI of FM Comparison, I'd be like, okay, we need to make Bootstrap do this. And Joe would go away for a week and come back and go, yeah, Bootstrap doesn't do that. Oh, okay, well, can we make it do this? No. Well, what about this?
Well, particularly Bootstrap View doesn't do that. We're running more limitations there than Bootstrap.
And that's a powerful library too, Bootstrap View. I mean, there's quite a few of them. There's Viewtify and a whole bunch of other opinionated libraries, and they all are just that. They're opinion. They have opinions. They have this is what a column should look like. This is what the table looks like. This is what your label looks like and where your label goes. You know, material design is another example of those kinds of things. Although it's a little bit less opinionated in some ways. And Tailwind has no opinion at all, and that's what makes it so flexible and so powerful. And the idea that of components. So you can go to Tailwind Components. I think it's tailwindcomponents.com. And you can find cards. I have this obsession with cards in terms of demos, because they just it's just something that we can't normally do. Flow a bunch of cards. Cards are like if you had a bunch of real estate agents and you wanted to show them all in a row and in little rectangles. So you can literally grab the chunk of code off that site, hit the copy button, paste it in my case, or in our developer's case, paste it in right into their edit. And it suddenly they're taking this found set of records in FileMaker, and it just presenting it as a bunch of rows of cards. And to see somebody's face when they first see that, it's like, holy cow, I haven't been able to do this for like years and years and years, to do stuff that's that easy.
Yeah. Yeah, I think, like, I'm not saying I would always use Tailwind or suggest people to always use it, but I think it makes sense to use things like Bootstrap and Material when you don't necessarily know what you want your UI to build look like. You just want tools to build on. So I want a bunch of pre-formatted fields and cards and things like that. So you've got those opinionated controls already there, and you're just assembling them into a UI. If you already know exactly what you want, which was, you know, in the FM comparison case, Dave had a real clear vision of how he wanted things to look and feel that just wasn't going to work with those frameworks. Those are designed in opinionated ways, in opinions that Dave does not share, to put it nicely. So we had a lot more flexibility, especially around like padding and text size and margins and all that stuff, where if we did that in Bootstrap, you'd be, every single item would just be overriding those default properties.
Yeah. One of the nice things is that you can do this. You can mix Tailwinds with other frameworks as well. And and it sounds like it's a crazy idea, but it's just augmentation classes. So, but you know what, as I was thinking, as you were saying that, one of the things we've done with BetterForms is, or at least I learned about a year ago, 2 years ago, I hired, a UX designer, and right away she actually applied for we were looking for somebody to write tests, because that's so fun, and I know Dave seems to love writing tests. I don't know, maybe you can write some tests for us or something, but I hate it personally. And but she had applied to that because she's done some coding, and turns out that her background is in UX, and she's a really, really good UX designer. And it opened up our eyes to, or it actually closed off my brain that I didn't have to think about design after that. And that was really, really nice too. That was from a project aspect, it was just awesome. And then we added another UX designer, Fred, who's consults with us in a partnership on bigger projects. And he's got some really, really top designs as well. And that's when my eyes really, really opened up to how important a designer is to an app. So now we're actually in the process, this week we're going to be hiring a full-time UX designer. They're not going to know anything about FileMaker. They're not going to know anything about BetterForms. They're going to only know about UX. I know it's pretty bold, but it's crazy how powerful it is. Like, we have a team right now of full and part-time people, of about 8, I guess. Majority are part-time freelance consultant developers, but there's some part-time, or some full-time as well. And this designer will be full-time. So they're going to work about 70% on our app, because it's just that important. You know, it's not bad looking now, but we want to make it just top-notch to be competitive.
Yeah, so I want to go back to something you said earlier before we got on the Tailwind rabbit hole. You mentioned that your view components have very little in them in terms of definition.
Yeah.
So I'm assuming that's because you're turning FileMaker fields and objects into HTML to render out for these forms?
No, actually. So here's kind of how BetterForms works. BetterForms has a bunch of components, and we'll call it an input field, a text area box, an HTML block, very similar to like a typical app builder would have. And since those components, when you instantiate one of those, that's effectively data. So you're going to design your page with some data. So for the most part, developers edit some JSON, and we have an enhanced JSON editor, which allows you to like embed HTML and JavaScript and things like that as well, for developers who want to use that. And they basically define an array, we'll call it, and the array could have, say, two objects, a first name field and a last name field, and or maybe three, and a button. And then on the front end, in BetterForms, when the app first loads, it downloads the schema, we call that, for that page, which is an array of three items. It takes those items and it looks, what's the first item? It's a type of input field. Okay, I know how to do that. And that's a component that's internal to BetterForms. So it draws, it renders that field, and it adds the appropriate classes and things like that. That's the styling that goes around that. And then it does the same thing for the second thing and the third thing, which is the button. So it's not actually, we don't go off the FileMaker layout. And I remember demoing my Better Forms just as a pure concept. We were at DevCon about 4 years ago, and we're sitting in the back of a room, and Mike Burgee was sitting beside me. We were talking about the projects because he does a lot of PHP stuff, and I did at the time as well. Mm-hmm. And I said, hey, check this out, right? And you gotta kind of have to whisper a little bit. And I slid my laptop over and I just showed him what it does. Now, we didn't have a user interface or anything like that at the time, just pure data, and it was rendering. And I said, oh, that's really cool. And that's the fundamental premise that, and he suggested, hey, why don't you make it based off of a FileMaker layout, make it easier for FileMaker developers. But the truth is, and this is gonna hurt, but the truth is most FileMaker layouts suck. And they totally do not render themselves into a web app.
Yeah, I wasn't meaning that the render from a FileMaker layout object. I mean, like, the way that you have, with the data API, you have to have a field on the utility layout to
don't be accessible. Do that.
I was assuming you were turning those into something that you could then translate into a UI component.
No, you know what? I looked at that, and we really considered it. Like, you know, when Mike made a suggestion there, I was like, okay, well, let me look into that. But it turns out that it's not really a good approach because your web interface.
No, that's not quite what I'm saying. Okay. I'm not talking anything at all about visual design.
Right.
I mean, to use the data API, you have to have a field on a layout for that data to be accessible via the API.
Okay. So what we do, what we do around that is, let's say you have a list of contacts. Right. Normally, if you were going to call those contacts with a data API, you hit the contacts table and you have a query, and then you would return, say, 20 records. Mm-hmm. Right. And that would give 20 records of data in the data API, which is smaller, we'll call lighter than the PHP version, which that would that returns even more data, the XML gateway, which the PHP layer sits on top of. So instead of doing that, we return a single record, single field. And then in that field, it has JSON. So we don't care about all the overhead that the XML gateway adds on, or that the data API for that matter adds on. We're only concerned about one path, one field of JSON, and we put all our data in there. So we encapsulate it or wrap it around in a single record.
So the FileMaker developer needs to get all the data into a field somewhere before that then?
No, actually, we take care of all of that. All that they have to do is they have a global variable in their script when their script runs. So if I click on that button on that layout that I described earlier with a first name and a last name, say in a button, I click on that button, it'll run a script. It'll do anything we want it to do, but it'll run a script, let's say, in FileMaker. That script will be presented with a variable, a global variable called the model. That's the equivalent of Vue.js's data model that everything is being bound to. Okay. And they can pick out their individual fields, model.firstname, model.lastname, and so on. And then after that, if they want to augment that, they can say model.firstname equals, and they can change it from Charles to Joe. And as soon as that script returns back to the front end, BetterForms will see that data changed, and it'll instantly update the front end. So a FileMaker developer does not need to know anything about even the data API or communications. They only have to understand what a variable is. BetterForms itself never really touches your direct file. It runs a script in your file. And we do that for a number of reasons. It gives a really, really good separation in terms of front end or separation of concerns of front end versus back end. So you have your business logic purely sitting in FileMaker. And that's why FileMaker is like crazy, crazy powerful back end for any web front end.
Yeah, so I'm just trying to understand how this would work. Like I've got a PHP custom web publishing app that has, I mean, essentially hundreds of API calls that need to be made. And those are made through a series of about 20 different layouts with collections of fields on them. And I'm just using get and post requests on those layouts to make those requests over the PHP API, now the data API. So I'm trying to figure out how that logic transfers over to, like, from a developer standpoint, what would I do differently in my solution? What would happen to all those layouts, and how would I get my intention for, say, request 104 that's going to return 1,000 records with these five fields? How do I tell the script to set that up in the first place? Or is that a separate script for every one of these?
Right. So you're really treating it as a, we'll call it an API, not an API first design, because that's something totally different. But you're sort of looking, you have most of your business logic is sitting in your PHP side then for that. Imagine your PHP side didn't have that business logic. You have to put it somewhere. So we have to put it like to find everybody's birthday that's this month, that kind of a thing. So that logic, that find logic, would sit now in FileMaker in a script. And you it can be as simple as a perform find. We usually use execute SQL quite a bit, but it can be as simple as something like that. And then that would find an array of contacts, and then you pass that array back to the front end. The front end's job is not to sift through that array or to do anything with it. It might have to do some UI filtering and maybe some ordering, some sorting, but that's about it. And then it just renders it. So that's where Vue.js comes in on the front end is okay. for rendering it. So there's very little, like in our back end, in our node server back end, there's very little business logic in there. There's only a little bit of stuff that routes based on domain. So FileMaker developers can have multiple domains and that can route automatically to different backend FileMaker databases and things like that. Other than that, there is zero business logic that's related to the developer. There's just some overhead. Does that make sense at all?
I think so. I'm just, it's a different way of doing things. And so I guess
it is.
It sounds like FM Better Forms, for every form or layout you're defining, you're also attaching a script telling it how to get its data. And then the developer writes that script itself.
Yeah, exactly. That's your business logic, right? So we put our business logic there because you think when you make changes, you have a front end and you make some changes on the front end, and then maybe sometimes you make some changes on the back end. Or you make a lot of changes in the back end and maybe some front end changes. They're usually almost independent as it really turns out. This is in an established app, not in a brand new app. Brand new app, you're developing equally.
Yeah.
But later on, it's, the person joins up or they sign up or whatever they do. And then a bunch of stuff has to happen in the back end. And that stuff is usually a lot more than what has to happen in the front end. So by keeping all that logic in FileMaker, it makes it FileMaker. That's our native tongue, if you will.
Okay. I'm just trying to understand the whole pipeline. From defining the form, you attach it to a script. The developer then writes the script to get and process the data according to their business logic. And the end of that script, they write it into a single record. And then you're...
No, they don't even have to do that. They don't even have to do the record. They just have to put the data back into a variable.
Okay.
And get this. We have this idea of actions, which is something that we had to, as a project, we had to come up with. And we didn't come up with it until about a year in to Better Forms. We needed a way of adding some business logic on the front end. Like there has to be some stuff like conditionally show things, navigate, move people around, that kind of stuff. And it's not practical to hit FileMaker. In our early betas, we hit FileMaker each time for that. You know, somebody clicks a button and FileMaker would say where to go. But we already know, like you click this button, go to this page, the detail page, for example. And so we added this idea of actions. Actions are really the same as FileMaker. FileMaker, when you draw a button, you can see it. It actually says, what is the action you want? Run a single step or run a script. We can do the same thing in FileMaker, in Better Forms. We have a button, we associate an action with that, and that action will we have about 20 or 30 or so actions. They're like a little mini language on the front end, and one of them could be a path that would take you to another page. Another one could be a function which would run some JavaScript that you can code. Another one is to run a hook or run a call to FileMaker, and now FileMaker itself can actually inject those actions. So you can be running, you can click a button, and then FileMaker can decide, well, this person should go to this layout. This person should get that data. This person should be logged out, whatever it is. And those are all actions that you can inject into a variable called actions on the back end. Okay. And that gives a ton of flexibility now. So that's our secret sauce. And yeah. I mean, you can certainly code this all out. If I had to ever write a PHP app again in the future, that's exactly how I build it again in the future. Like I wouldn't bother going back to adding the business logic into the front end, or sorry, into the server side, the PHP side. I would keep it purely as a proxy, the back end.
Okay. So I guess I'm just trying to understand this pipeline. So thinking, so outside of FM Better Forms for a second, just help me understand this pipeline of getting data, because I think I might be able to use it for what I'm working on later. But essentially, I guess when I tried to do this in PHP a couple years ago, this wasn't possible. It sounds like you're calling a script that is doing some data processing. The end of the script has a blob of JSON, and then you're returning that into a single record that then the data API can request.
Correct.
Is that what you're doing?
Yeah, that's it.
Okay, so the script itself, the perform script step data API thing, isn't returning the results, because that didn't seem to work last time I tried that.
It's where we put the results into a variable. We usually use a global variable for this. It's one of the cases that global variables work really well for.
But the data API can't see a global
variable. At the end of, we have some wrapper scripts. So we don't directly call, BetterForms doesn't directly call your business file. We'll call it your legacy business file. Instead, we call a small helper file that sits in between. It's a proxy file. It's a FileMaker file as well. But for every call that comes in, it creates a record. And that gives us like an inbox. So we can see the data coming in, and then we can see the data that your script is producing or your FileMaker app is producing. And that makes it easy to debug now. Because another thing with the problem with conventional coding is it's really hard to debug stuff that's running on the server.
Yeah.
Because you don't know what's going on. So instead of passing too much stuff to the server, we kind of moved that logic over to the PHP side because it's easier to debug there when, you know, it's transparent. You can add breakpoints, if you will. So that's one of the biggest, that's a big kind of a, I guess you could say a design pattern that we do that's different that way, is by adding that proxy file, we can also route or dispatch the incoming call. So we have about 25% of our users have vertical applications, like software as a service or some type of vertical.
Yeah.
What I call considered vertical is when the application is the business. Right. You may not be selling it as a service, but the application itself is pretty much the business. That's their secret sauce.
Yeah.
And with those people, some of them have, almost all of them have legacy backends. So they have multiple FileMaker databases. But the holy grail in any software as a service is to have a multi-tenant application. But that is nearly impossible. I've seen, and I've probably sat in one-on-one calls with, I would say, between 350 and 450 developers over the past 3 years. And I have yet to see, or sorry, I've seen, I saw just one that was a true multi-tenant backend in FileMaker. And it's generally really hard. But when we separate the concerns and we have everything being very script handling or script oriented, let's call it script first type interface, then it becomes really easy for them to do that. And that's another reason why we use that helper file, because that can dispatch based on the domain. You can have, you know, domain A goes to this file, domain B goes to that file. So you have these multiple FileMaker backends. So they don't have to change anything in their actual file, but they still have the same front end. So they're reducing the amount of code base that they have to maintain.
Okay. So at some point, you have to make an HTTP request to the FileMaker server. Are you doing that request to this helper file?
Correct.
And that's running a script and then getting a result in the variable and then returning that result via the single record.
And the helper file, the helper file actually does the conversion and puts it back into that single record, like you said. So that's exactly what's happening.
So it's basically hit a URL that executes a process on the helper file. It calls a script in the production file, whatever you want to call it, business logic file. That script does whatever the developer needs it to do to find data, run operations, create stuff. And then that script will return a result that you could then put into a global variable. Then you've got some data munching stuff that takes that variable and puts it into a single record that you can then return as part of the original request. Or is this a request thing?
Yeah, just that's exactly how that works. And then what we do is we take that data, we proxy it back out, and we don't, we do some caching, but we don't do caching too much on the calls of our clients, that our clients make. We use a Redis cache in BetterForms. That's part of our framework. Mm-hmm. And we don't normally do some caching that of that script call, because chances are that data needs to be unique or fresh.
Yeah.
But we do have that capability. So that's something that we haven't surfaced, but we have the ability to basically cache that call, and that deburdens FileMaker quite a bit too. So we find that, you know, it's pretty reasonable to have, like, we've had some people that have thousands. We have one one developer, and he has a vertical. And on Friday nights, his app will have, you know, 1,000 hits, or sorry, not 1,000 hits, 1,000 users reporting data in, 1,000 employees, if you will, contractors. And, you know, that happens within a very short period of time. So for those kinds of things, it's pretty performant, that technology, that method. And PHP is going to be just as performant, slightly more, in fact, because you wouldn't be running the script. But for what we found, it's we haven't found anybody who has any limitations so far.
Nice. It took me a while to wrap my head around it, but I think I get it now.
It's a different, yeah. It's a different approach, definitely. Yeah. And that's, we evolved that, if you will. It was basically to deal with all of those concerns or those problems. Like, how do I pass that logic on to the developer and make it easy for them? We don't want to have a FileMaker developer. Like, I don't consider myself a coder. I kind of take that as a bit of an insult, because it implies that you just take something and you encode it, right?
Yeah.
But, I mean, certainly it's a percentage of what we do. But I like to use the term developer. And I think our clients, as clients of FM Betterforms, they're all developers. You know, they take something, deal with a customer, which could be an in-house, could be their boss, or it could be whatever. And they develop the solution. You know, they're like an architect in a way. Of their solution. So they don't really need to learn yet. They don't have to become awesome web developers to make awesome web apps, mm-hmm. right? They just have to understand some really core concepts, just like we do in FileMaker. We don't have to be data analysis specialists just to be able to use FileMaker. We, you know, we can kind of just go in there and hack away and it works.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. I tend to think of the difference between like engineers and developers. Like, engineers are people who make APIs and frameworks and contribute to open source projects and stuff like that. And I am a developer. I consume stuff like that. Like, I use Tailwind. I don't make Tailwind. I use Vue. I'm not working on Vue, things like that.
So let's talk about Vue, because I'm kind of a real Vue, I don't know, what do you call it? Fanboy, I guess.
Yeah.
And you know, I introduce Vue as much as we can to every one of our developers, because with Betterforms, we only have to do a very, very light amount of Vue. Like, you guys had talked about the Vue store, and we use that internally in our app, but we don't directly expose it to the developer. They can actually access the Vue store, but we don't make them have to learn anything. We just take care of all of that stuff. And instead, what we do is we give them the ability to do the really important, the real fun stuff in Vue, which is like the V4s, which is like an iteration loop, and the VIFs, and bind classes. And those are the top three things that people use in Vue. And we just introduced this concept of components to the developers, the front-end developers, where they can create a component, create a button now, and reuse that button in different apps. And we're just in the middle of sort of learning best practices for that. But just the fundamental stuff, when you show somebody who's never really done any front end, everybody sort of knows what an H1 tag is because they've looked under the hood at some point in time. But to understand what the V4 does, like that iterator, and how it can just repeat something, it's pretty neat when you see the light bulb go off and then you think, holy cow, look at all the stuff I can do with this. So
yeah, and being able to do all of that right in the HTML template section for a Vue component. I mean, it's similar to PHP. Like, if you use PHP the kind of old school way without any of the object oriented stuff, and you're just using it as a hypertext preprocessor, you're basically like, PHP at its core is something that you use to make HTML. And that's really what the Vue template system is. You're writing HTML, but you can also write these little template tags and do things that don't get rendered. So your logic and your bindings and stuff like that. But then you could also have anything that is an HTML attribute can also be basically a computed attribute or the result of a calculation. So, again, in FileMaker terms, imagine if everything in the inspector was programmable. And you can say, just like we have like the data visibility thing or the object visibility calculation, imagine if every object in the inspector had a little calculation thing to go along with it.
Well, it's kind of funny you mention that, because So our schema, just jumping back to my original example, you have this first name and you have a label. Let's say there's a label key. It's a key in the JSON object that defines that page, and it's called first space name. And you wanted to make that a calculation. It's like, well, what if you want to make it a calculation, but the next developer doesn't want it a calculation, and the next developer wants it a calculation of a different language, so it can be multilingual. So that one, you know, there's everybody has these different things. So going back to what you said, well, what if you have to make everything a calculation? So a few years ago, we built this thing. It's a basically a calculation engine. And what it does is when that schema is first loaded into the browser, we look for an underscore calc. And there's a couple other suffixes as well. But we look for an underscore calc. Now, we don't know what part of Betterforms is going to consume that key, but we know that key is important. Right? Because it's in there in the first place. So it could be a label. It could be a type. It could be a maximum, a minimum. It could be anything, right? It could even be a binding of what field that field is going to be bound to. So we added this underscore calculation engine. And what it does is it looks through and it finds all of these things. And it goes and adds some function around that key. So it takes that key and it more or less replaces the underscore calc with the original root of the key. Let's call it label. And then it adds a JavaScript in the object. It adds a getter and a setter, actually a getter it adds. And then that getter, what it does is it renders some JavaScript functionality. So this is a little bit confusing to think about, but basically what we do is by adding an underscore calc, we can put JavaScript into the value of that key, and that will get evaluated on the fly and remain reactive. And that's the real hard part. It remains reactive in the system in the right context. And that is the real powerful stuff. Like after you have that ability that you can just make anything reactive right away, like we can do that in Vue. But this is even easier. This is like one step above that now, where we can just say, I want the label to be, you know, based on whatever the active language is, I want it to be this key in that active language. And then it says, you know, Buongiorno or whatever. So in order to get there, that was really, really hard. Well, it's not only learning and, you know, really learning and understanding how true object properties work underneath the hood of JavaScript, because we've all kind of poked around and you start expanding an object and it just seems to go forever. You keep looking and there's more listeners and all this garbage underneath, and you go deeper and deeper, and then I just give up. I say I don't even know what's going on down there, because it's just like a black hole. But one of the hardest parts for us was to understand the concept, because this is a reactive property. And this is the kind of the basis of all reactivity and how that whole system of React and Vue and any other reactive framework works, is to make sure that we don't know what the context that the developer is going to evaluate it in, because they could be building anything, right? So that could be in a modal window, and a modal window is like a card modal in FileMaker. It's a totally separate entity. So to figure out the context, we had this bug, and we had it where the modal wouldn't evaluate properly, because it would evaluate in a parent context instead of in a card modal. Mm-hmm. Right. And so I was at the VueConf a number of years ago, and I was taking an advanced class from the guy who primarily worked on the Vue docs, Chris Fritz. And I asked him about this, and he goes, oh, that's a hard problem. Right. And he goes, we can do this hacky, solve it hacky, this kind of way. Those didn't kind of work. So the next year, I said, I'm going to talk to Evan Yu, the founder of Vue, because I've talked to him before, but just, you know, having a glass of wine later on, like after the events. And I'm sitting in his advanced class. And then the first break comes up and I basically lay out the framework, because it's hard to explain to people that you have a dynamic framework that doesn't really do anything until the developer tells it. That's a real hard concept.
You've abstracted Vue.
Yeah. And it's how do you tell them that? And they say, well, why didn't you do that? Why didn't you just, you know, that's what, whenever I post something on the forums, it's like, oh, just do this. Well, no, you can't do that. You don't understand. there's no opinion to this, right? This is like the framework of the framework on top of the framework.
Wish I could filter out all of the internet that just has the words like just do.
Yeah, exactly, right? We need a filter. There should be a Stack Overflow that just click, boom, done, gone. Mm. Just removes it all, right? I don't care about spam. I just want to, why don't you, and why are you, and just do, and all of those other keywords.
If you think it's that easy, then you don't understand the problem.
Yeah. And it's almost an insult to yourself because you know that, like, maybe you need to have some kind of street cred type thing that you're not allowed to say that to somebody who's obviously asked smart questions. So I go up to Evan, and this is now that lunchtime now. It's the second break. I've already prefaced him with the app. And then I go up to him and I say, okay. And he finally starts to get the picture, right? And I say, okay, here's the app. Here's how it works. He's heard about FileMaker. He doesn't really know anything about it. But it's irrelevant anyway. And I said, this is how the editor works. And this is how these people can add this stuff. But we're losing context here. And I can't tell when this reactivity calculation runs what the environment is. And he looks at it for a while and he goes, and he asked me a bunch of questions. And he goes, what about this? And what about that? And I said, no, that won't work for this reason or that reason. And he understood. He's a pretty bright guy. And then he finally says to me, he goes, wow, that's a really hard problem. And I thought, oh, flip, man, I'm done. that was like my whole career just went down the river. This is the guy who invented this stuff. And he's like, oh, that's a real hard problem. But then later on, we talked a bit more and come up with an idea, which you ended up solving. So I literally had this bug for like 2 years with that until we solved it. It was brutal.
Yeah. Yeah. The thing that I think is interesting about Vue and why I'm working on it with Dave on his project, and I've dabbled with it on a couple of side projects. I've taken a look at React as well, and I may do something in React in the future, but I'm hesitant to because Vue seems to do everything I want it to do.
Yeah, and Vue is huge now, right? It's huge. It's surpassed React in terms of GitHub stars, whatever that means. But it's really, really big. But the fundamental difference between Vue and React that I've noticed I've done some React. I went and spent about 6 months looking at frameworks and trying to figure out what I'm going to build my build better forms on. And React is kind of like taking JavaScript and mixing some HTML inside the JavaScript. Whereas Vue is kind of like the other way around. It's taking HTML, putting some decorators sort of inside that HTML, and then putting some JavaScript beside it or below it, kind of thing.
Yeah, for me, it keeps the HTML part HTML.
Exactly.
And the JavaScript part JavaScript. Yeah. And you can mix and match a little bit, but at its default level, it's a separation of concerns thing. When my brain is in HTML mode, I can be in HTML mode. And then when I shift to JavaScript mode, I'm really only thinking about JavaScript, except for those weird spots where I need my JavaScript to generate some HTML. But my brain stays nicely separated because those aren't the same problem in my head.
Yeah. I really like with the Vue components, we've got the template HTML at the top, then the script in the middle, and then any CSS at the bottom. You've got CSS for that. So we've got a series of components that are defined that way. And then our views are basically just template code. There is no accompanying JavaScript code to go with them because they're basically just a collection of components. So we have a view as an endpoint, basically a URL that we're going to in a route. And that view just presents a whole bunch of components configured together that work together. So when you look at our main window with the category sidebar, the item list, and the detail card, you're seeing three different views rendered. Actually seeing one view rendering two other views rendering multiple components in each one. But it's just kind of neat how it's easy to debug and figure out exactly where something is because you can just name your views and components really simply and kind of keep I think of a view kind of like a FileMaker layout. And a component would be anything that goes on that layout. So our views are very high level. Like here is where you define stuff, but we're not defining business logic there. It's just here you lay out the controls. But how those controls work are all abstracted away into those components. And then these components can be super simple or very complicated. Like our detail card is a component, but it has dozens of subcomponents.
And that's really cool about it, right? That's what makes it so awesome. Another thing that you can do in Vue and that you can't do very easily at all in React is, well, I wouldn't say you can't, you can, but we dynamically, remember BetterForms is not really an app. It's a framework. And we do have an app, which is the editor, which happens to be built with itself. but it's a framework. So, and that's a hard one too, because it really messes up. We just changed the way our development environments work, and it's so hard for the whole team to work on it, because it's like, if I save something here, will it save, or is this development, or am I, because there's four levels of inception, right? You have you have basically your FileMaker code, which is your back-end business logic. You have our base code, which is our Node.js stuff and Vue.js stuff that's written. Then we have our BetterForms editor, which is a BetterForms app built in the environment. And then we have the stuff that that editor may be editing. Sometimes it's itself. So there's four layers. So it really, really messes everybody up. But because of that, we need to, a developer to be able to basically return a JSON object of a contact with a first name and a last name, and they should be able to go into HTML, add some curly braces, and put, you know, model.name first, and it works. And they're going to change that. Now, there's no, that code doesn't exist anywhere, like that HTML and the curly braces and stuff. We dynamically on the fly render that Vue.js code. So we compile that into a Vue.js template string, and then we actually render it that way. So that's a little bit more of the secret sauce that way. And that was another really hard component, but that's something you can do in Vue that you can't easily do in most frameworks, because it's they call it a progressive framework, because you can use sort of as little as or as much as you want, and that is not something that holds true with React.
You just said something that I gotta confirm. The FM Better Forms editor is an FM Better 100%. Forms app. You dog fooded that
100%. You know what? I was Dave Ramsey from Geist. was giving him a demo. Dave Ramsey from Geist. Sorry, the wrong Dave. Dave. The other Dave. Graham. Sorry. Dave Graham. He's talking to me and goes, Graham. Well, what would really be neat is if you made the editor out of Better Forms. I was like, yeah, why don't I do that? So, boom, I was on a trip down south. I think it was in Jamaica. And it's like, I sat at the bar and basically coded most of the editor, or at least the fundamental parts. There's so much has changed since, but you know, the real core concept. And it's like, just getting it to the point where you can use it to save suddenly made our development go like 100 times faster, because now we have an environment which we didn't have that before. But yeah, it's purely a Better Forms app. And that's really important for us, because then we understand the pains that a developer have. So.
Yeah.
Wow. That's yeah, really impressive.
Ugly hard too. So don't ever do this, people. Don't kids, if you're playing the home game, don't build a framework.
Yeah. Dave, FM comparison needs to be able to diff itself.
Yeah. So I have something, I thought I wanted to bounce off you guys. I have, a kind of an idea of levels of hardness in code. And I think about this all the time when I hear you guys talking about stuff. I think the easiest thing that people start off with is like a hello world, right? Just to get to see if it lights up, if the Christmas lights go on or whatever. And then I got five levels here, is what I'm thinking. And so feel free to interrupt me and tell me I'm wrong. Then I think there's like a to-do app, or the Stack Over, the Hacker News type app or whatever, some kind of functional app. And that's a lot, quite often where we start, right? And then
a list-making app.
And that goes up, that's a really big section, right? Because that goes right up to your finished app for the most part. But then I was thinking, what's really hard, and I've had to code one of these once before, is a parser. I think that's... Right. And I think Dave will agree with me on this. Right. That's like another level up, because now you're looking at all these crazy things that can happen. And I wrote a very small parser for Geist's, I can't think of the name now, a vergenerator for it parses a curl string.
So in my experience, Dave doesn't even get out of bed unless there's a parser involved.
Yeah. Right. But I think that's a level. And then I think that makes you think about what kinds of things you can run into from that are unknowns. And then I think another one from there is a framework. Because a framework is, now you have to think about what kinds of crazy stuff that somebody else can come up with. Mm-hmm. Not just what they can do, but what they will do, what they need to or they'll want to do. So you have to think about, you know, people's opinion. How much opinion do you add to the stuff?
I'm not convinced that a parser is a lower level problem than a framework.
I have a little back and forth arrow next to these 2 points because I knew you were going to say that. I think a parser is maybe a little bit higher. It's a different type of thing, though. A framework, you can't have any opinion to. You have to really be...
Yeah.
They're different. They're like left and right side brain things, I think, almost, in terms of the management.
A parser has a correct result where a framework...
And what do you think? What do you think would be number five? I got one. I don't want to say what it is, but what I think it is. It's kind of the opposite of sort of these.
Designing a language?
I was going to say a compiler, which is basically designing language. I would think that's like that. That's like that's another level of, you know, code guru voodoo stuff going on there.
So we're running close to an hour. We're going to skip Dave's update and my update, and we'll have those for you in the next episode, dear listener. But I was hoping we could close out with a couple minutes discussion on the Apple M1 Max that were announced a couple weeks ago. What do you guys think about that?
Supposed to be really fast. And it's not like 30% faster. It's like, you know, whole orders of, or almost an order of magnitude faster or something, right? Is that right? Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Sorry. Yeah.
3 to 4 is what I was usually seeing.
Yeah. So they're consumer products. These aren't necessarily pro machines. Contrary to what I said last episode, they did actually unveil a Mac Mini. I didn't think they would, but that was the first thing that they talked about. A little Mac Mini. And then a MacBook Air and a MacBook Pro with heavy finger quotes around the Pro, 13-inch. So three kind of lower-end, lower-power devices with some pretty neat performance, but also some weird limitations in how you can configure them. But they seem very cool, but also very uninteresting in a lot of ways, which is probably good for this type of transition.
Well, this is an M1, so imagine what an M2 and an M3 are going to be like next year.
Yeah, it seems like they have to prove the validity of their silicon platform with these, so they didn't want to really shake everything up in the process, which is why I don't think we're seeing like completely redesigned things or touchscreen iMacs or 2-in-1 devices or, you know, whatever is coming next.
Yeah, and. For that purpose, I think these are great computers. Like, for the purpose of proving the validity of the concept, they basically hit it out of the park, short of 16 gig of RAM. Guys, really? That's the best you can do?
Well, I mean, if you're like building parsers and stuff, but for the rest of us, you know.
Yeah, I mean, they're not, Dave is not the target audience for these machines. These are for people who probably will never install an IDE.
But do you, like, I develop on a 2011. It was my first iMac. You know, I got a good gig and I went out and dumped $3,000 onto this machine at the time. And the glass is broken because I have a stand-up desk and my kid put it down to play a game or something and fell off and the chair's underneath and... And it's literally got tape all over it to keep the air flowing through it and stuff. It's the most ghettoest looking machine. And it, you know what? It's my living. So I'm okay with it. Yeah. Like, so I don't know. How much do we need, I guess? Yeah. Having said that, yeah, I might buy one. Yeah,
I don't need as much. I used to think I needed a lot more specs than I did. And largely because I was trying to do the VR development in Unity and Unreal Engine, and those needed much more powerful machines. But since I've kind of given up on that and given up on the Xcode stuff, really I run browsers and VS Code, and like I could probably be working on a Chromebook if I wanted to work on a Chromebook, which I don't. But I don't need top tier specs anymore.
They're pretty reasonably priced, though, I think, right? The new Macs.
Yeah, the laptops are about the same. The Mac Mini, I think, came down a little bit. Or was it? I think it was the Mac Mini that came down.
I think so.
Maybe like $50.
And
bucks.
I think the performance running under whatever emulation mode it is, I've heard it's just as good or better. Is that right? So.
Yeah. Yeah, so the interesting thing that these machines do that the Intel Macs don't do is that they run iOS apps. And I think that's really neat. I'm not sure how useful that is, but that's definitely an added value proposition. If you've got a bunch of apps that you want to use that you already have on your phone, like there's a little finance, like personal finance tracker called SpendStack that I use that is on my iPhone, but it's not on my Mac, but now it could be on a Mac.
Are people going to run FileMaker Go apps on there? I think that's...
I want to find that out. If it will even run, like that would be really cool.
I would think FileMaker wouldn't really like that too much.
Yeah, it's up to the developer to opt out of the run your iOS app on the Mac. So it'd be interesting to see if Claris actually opted out or if they just left it enabled. I don't know. So I ordered one.
Nice.
I said I wasn't going to, and then I did.
Did you?
In fact, I spent about 2 weeks saying, nah, I don't need that. Well, maybe, and kind of going back and forth. And I added it to my cart 50 times, and I configured over and over again. And I ordered one about 2 hours ago. And I ordered the absolute base model Mac Mini, which sounds weird, but I don't need any storage on it for what I'm using it for. Like my Mac now, I check my storage. I've got 125 gigs on here, and it's almost all programs. A little bit of podcast data and some repos. I think there are more NPM modules installed than anything else. So I don't need a lot there. The RAM, I'm going to test a hypothesis and see how well I do on 8 gigs of RAM. I have 16 now, and I never use more than 10. So I'll probably be paging for some stuff, but I'm not going to install everything on it. Like I'm not going to install Creative Cloud or any of those apps on it for now. And so I basically ordered the $649 Mac Mini. After tax, it was around $750. But after my iPad Pro trade-in, I paid $261 for it.
What did they do with those?
No idea.
And that little robot that's supposed to take them apart, is that a thing? Is that real? Yeah.
I don't think they're taking it apart for trade-in. I think they're refurbishing it and reselling it. But yeah. Yeah, I don't think they would have given me $500.
Like, I'd like to have one of those robots just in my house. And then when somebody comes over, let's put your phone over here.
Can you charge my phone?
Sure. Here's a new charger. Well, that's pretty neat. Look at that. It even grabs my phone. What? Yeah.
Just give him a little bag of sand on the way out the door.
Yeah, I'm really hoping I can stretch my DTK long enough that machines that I am interested in will start to pop out.
Yeah, I'm kind of interested. Like, I went down to the base model iPhone with the SE and the... You know, I've got an iPad mini that I've had for about a year, base model iPad mini. So I think I'm going to, because I'm the type of moron who's just going to always buy another computer, I may as well stop getting the fancy ones and just get the base model stuff.
I've tried to adopt that strategy and it just never works for me. I go in there and start pricing the thing out and then end up maxing something.
Do you guys always use a laptop for your main machine or?
I have most of the time. I had an iMac for a while, and I have a laptop. I always need a laptop because I do occasionally have to go somewhere, but I'm just going to keep, I'm going to keep my current Mac laptop indefinitely until I know the Apple Silicon can do everything that it does. But at which point I'll just keep my Windows laptop for those kind of occasional client trips. And then just maybe have the Mac Mini in my office. But I have a Mac now that I almost always use in clamshell. Like 99% of the time, it's just sitting on the desk in clamshell mode. And then once in a while, I need to take it somewhere. It's the exception being podcast recording day. Like I'm sitting in a different room than my office where it's a bit quieter on the laptop with the microphone. But yeah.
I have a 2015 27-inch iMac that I bought basically to write FM Perception because I started it on a 2011 17-inch laptop, and eventually the code got so complicated that Xcode couldn't keep up. Like there were certain files that were long enough that when you started typing, you could see the individual keystrokes popping up. It was like letter, letter, letter. And that's a really painful way to edit. So got the 27-inch iMac, all of that went away. And Xcode has gotten faster since then for dealing with Swift. So, and it virtualized Windows beautifully. So I could write the Windows version of FM Perception on the 27-inch iMac, which was great.
Is that how you sort of reward yourself, Dave, like, or justify like those things? Because I've done that. Like, okay, I got this big project, or I just finished a big project and I'm going to go treat myself, kind of thing. Or you just...
I try really hard to avoid the concept of rewarding myself in that way, because I can always find an excuse to reward myself. There's always a reason to do that. I was trying very hard to just keep using a machine until it couldn't be used for its task anymore. And, you know, I was writing, you know, the 17-inch laptop with an SSD in it was a phenomenally functional machine for general FileMaker development and things like that. And then when I started writing something where I just literally couldn't create the things I wanted to create on that hardware anymore, I replaced it. And that requires almost no justification. Like, the thing I'm trying to do, this computer can't do it. A new computer can.
Yeah, then it's no-brainer.
Buy a new computer.
Makes sense.
Yeah, it's... I don't have to justify anything at that point. It's a requirement. Yeah.
That's like my espresso machine. It's very much... It falls into that park, too.
Yeah. I do have a 15-inch MacBook Pro that... 9 times out of 10 is used at DevCon or Claris Engage. Like, that's literally what I bought it for, was when I needed to go demo at a trade show. Because I didn't want to haul a 27-inch iMac through an airport.
Yeah, I mean, I decided to get the base model because I'm thinking this probably won't be a machine with a lot of longevity. So if I'm going to replace it after a year or two, why spend $1,200 when I can spend $600?
Yeah. Well, and to a certain degree, that's what my developer transition kit is doing. It was a $500 Mac Mini that I'm going to use until Apple says give it back to me. Give it back to them. And then I'll have to worry about, okay, what's the cool thing out now that will make my life easier and faster?
So yeah, I ordered it this morning. It should be here tomorrow. So I will be able to answer the question of, will FileMaker go work on it? So yeah, I'm going to try to set it up as a development machine, but I would not be surprised if there's lots of work that I just can't do for the short term. Like, can I install Node? Maybe. We'll see.
I'm 99% sure you can, just because in the end, Node is JavaScript.
Yeah.
And it's supposed to be able to run JavaScript really well. Like, you may have a bigger problem with the new OS than
definitely.
New hardware.
Big Sur is going to be the big gotcha to these things. I've seen a lot of people having a lot of issues with it on the new machines and on the regular stuff. I have not upgraded this machine to it, and probably, I don't know, I'll probably keep this one in the Catalina era. I wish this had Mojave on it, but it doesn't. It has Catalina. But I'll keep my quote-unquote stable Mac, which one of the reasons I bought this, I mentioned last week that I was having all kinds of weird issues with this haunted, terrible Mac. I reformatted it last week, and I'm still having unrelated issues to those. I'm still having graphics issues where one out of every 3 times I use this thing, I just have weird graphic issues and I need to restart. So I am eager to replace this machine with anything else, because it has been just a weird series of bugs and annoyances.
So, Charles, how long do you think your 2011 iMac is going to last?
Well, you know what? I'm not sure, but I do notice it starting to just feel a tiniest bit slow. It was an i7, the faster one, the faster graphics, blah, blah, blah. You know, it's the top one at the time. And It's totally fine. Like I do my most of pretty much all my development in a Cloud9, AWS Cloud9 ID. Mm-hmm. So that way we have two or three dev environments there. And then I can jump on one code base if Eduardo's working on something else, because him and I are the ones who primarily work on the backend code. And that it works out really, really well for us. And it's done in a browser, so it doesn't use much for resources. Betterforms, the app, is in a browser. And then FileMaker, which works really well on low performance machines, I think. Mm-hmm. So it's totally fine. I do play the odd game on it, or one game, this tanks game that my son and I play sometimes, but that's about it, and hardly ever that. And he makes fun because he's got some gaming machine and he's going on about all his cores and stuff. And I said, oh yeah, let's see which one pays the rent, you know, like that kind of thing.